yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Today we're going to turn back to an issue we've been visiting on several occasions over the past year, and that's the immigrants' rights movement. And undocumented immigrants and immigrants' rights in general. And today we have two guests, David Bacon and Alexandra Early. Some of you who have been following the news, the press, have no doubt recognized that a new issue in the immigrants' rights spectrum has appeared here, and that is the issue of tens of thousands of children now crossing the southern borders from Central America. So today we're going to talk about that issue within the context of the broader issue of immigrants' rights and ask ourselves, is legislation now dead? As you may know, the Tea Party victory defeating Eric Cantor, one of the leaders of the Tea Publicans in the House, U.S. House of Representatives, recently, with a very right-wing Tea Publican, who's replacing him, has all but killed any effort at even a tepid immigrants' rights legislation this year in Congress. Now, Obama is, will he go it alone? After all, Hispanics and people from Latin America, that block of vote pretty much put him in office in 2012, that and some union labor votes in Michigan and Ohio and so forth, but Hispanics made the big difference, youth and labor, in putting him in office, and so far nothing much has been done. Can he do anything? Well, there's this thing called executive action. Yes, he can do something, and quite a bit. And we'll see if he's really going to take executive action now to do something, because anything in terms of legislation in Congress is pretty much out of the question, particularly before the midterm elections coming up. And, of course, he is faced with this issue of children crossing the border, more than 50,000 in the last 6 months, children by themselves crossing the border, and another 40,000 of women with children crossing the border. It's a humanitarian issue. It's not just an immigration issue. What do? Put these little kids in concentration camps along the border somewhere, or you take them and shift them from state to state? They really don't know what to do with it at all. Except, of course, looks like we're going to have another big push on deportations, and this time it'll be kids. Because Obama, as you may know, is the record holder in terms of deportations. Over 2 million have been deported by Obama, many times breaking up families, sending parents and or children back across the border, and other family members remain here and so forth, breaking up families. So we got to have a new, more intense deportation policy. What's going to happen along the border? Well, he's asked Congress for another $2 billion to intensify border deportations. Well, we don't know yet. We'll see fairly shortly. And will he announce some carrot as well as some stick? Carrot probably, on behalf of immigrants and immigrants' rights. Will he have allow more work permits? Well, we don't know. We'll see. But my guess is you'll see some pie-in-the-sky promises right before the November election so he can tie in the Hispanic vote again. And prior to that, it probably will be more money for more deportations and more border patrols and who knows what. Well, anyway, we're going to see that. But my two guests here today are going to join the discussion with me, particularly focusing on this issue of latest issue of children crossing the border in tens of thousands. What do we do about it? Humanitarian issue as well. I have two guests here. One is Alexandra Early, who's been writing on this topic. Alexandra has spent the last 4 years in El Salvador working as co-coordinator for the solidarity organization U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities. And prior to that, she represented nursing home workers in the Bay Area and the National Union of Healthcare Workers. She's a Latin American Studies graduate from Wesleyan University, and she's written extensively, as I said, on U.S. foreign policy in Central America, so she knows what's going on in Central America. She's also a campaign coordinator for the Richmond, City of Richmond Progressive Alliance. We'll be talking about what's going on in Richmond, California, in the city, and grassroots organizing there in some future show, but for now, she's one of the participants there. I also, hopefully, will have David Bacon, who we've had on before, join us. David is a longtime immigrants' rights activist, well-known journalist on immigrant labor rights, and award-recommended and award photojournalist whose work has been very well recognized on numerous occasions. Most of his work and his photojournalist work is related to Latin America and immigrants. Alexandra, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Hello. How about David? David, are you on yet? Oh, David. I hope he got the call-in number. But anyway, we'll have to just move ahead, Alexandra, you and I.
Okay.
And talk about
Sounds
this
good.
Issue. Why don't you give us a background? I know you've written something recently. Why don't you tell us if the readers want to go and access your article for their own background, and then tell us what the issue is, this latest issue, and what you've been writing about on this immigrants' rights movement thing.
Mm-hmm. So the most recent article I wrote was really in response to some of the coverage that we've been seeing on this issue, specifically. I got fired up reading an article in the New York Times by a conservative journalist named Ross Douthat. I'm not sure of the pronunciation. And he was one of these, conservatives who are looking at what's going on, this humanitarian crisis on the border, and looking at it as an example of why the Obama administration's kind of what they see as a lax take on immigration and not enforcing our immigration laws is creating this humanitarian crisis. And so I really got angry about this article because I think it's an example of the press coverage, which is really judging and blaming Central American parents who are sending their kids to the U.S. And it's using all of this as an excuse to, like you're saying, to shut down any chance for, comprehensive immigration reform. And it's not, I having lived for 4 years in El Salvador, I saw the conditions that push people out of El Salvador, I also went to Honduras a number of times, Guatemala, seeing those conditions that push people to go to the U.S. And so it made me so angry to see this man who really doesn't know anything about what's going on in Central America, blaming Central American parents and, using this humanitarian issue, which is not just a humanitarian crisis on the border with these kids getting, caught by immigration and what do we do with them, but it's a humanitarian crisis in Central America that is pushing these kids to leave. And so, I think it's, we have to look at this as I'm glad in a way that there's more attention being drawn to this issue, but it's really upsetting to see the way that the right-wing media is, manipulating the whole situation to shut down immigration reform when this should be a chance where we say, okay, well, what's going on in Central America that pushes people to leave, and what can we do about that? You know, how can we get to the root causes of immigration?
Yes. Well, obviously, the right wing and Republicans in general and some Democrats have no intention whatsoever, never did, on doing anything about immigration. And this plays into their hand right before the November election, gives them an opportunity to deflect their lack of intention and interest and action on this and use it as a scapegoat to blame Obama. And, of course, Obama's hands aren't clean on this either. He's the biggest deporter of people for, you know, in U.S. history. But it plays into their hands, and the question is, what will Obama do? Will he tack to the right, as he usually does when he's under attack, which he's been for 6 years, or will he move in a more humanitarian direction and do something about this? My guess is, he'll ask for more money, he'll get more money, but the money will be earmarked for more police work, and it won't really solve the problem. Spending more money on police has not solved the problem, and it's not going to solve the problem. And, of course, it's silly to think that that fence and whatever kind of electronic or actual fence they put up can do anything about stopping the immigration flow, because, as you point out, it's a problem in the economy and society in these countries, in Latin America, Central America, and, a lot of the cause of it is the economic crisis there and the displacement of people and jobs in Central America, because American businesses move down there and destroy the agriculture. And what do these people do? Starve or go north to find work? You know, I mean,
right.
It's okay for
right.
capital to flow into from the U.S. there. I mean, that's no problem, even given all the disruptions it causes. But it's not okay for labor to flow in the other direction. But
right. And I think what I tried to point out in this article, and this is the same thing, as I was writing this, I was like, oh man, I wrote this exact same article after the first time I went to El Salvador, so back in 2008, and it just shows you how little has changed, you know, that still in the discussion about immigration policy, nobody is talking about what can we do so that people actually have what they say in El Salvador is the right not to migrate. Like, people also have a human right to be treated with dignity at the border, but they also have a human right to stay in their home countries and actually have opportunities and be able to have a good life in their home country. And that's the part that's kind of left out of discussion. I think, you know, I read yesterday in the New York Times about this town in California, in Southern California, where they're protesting these kids being put in a deportation center in their town.
Yeah, Murrieta, I think it was, right? Murrieta, California.
Yeah, Murrieta, yeah. And people talk about, I mean, I think people have a misconception also that it's a pull, that people come to the U.S. because they think life is so good here and they really want to live here. And, like, the Salvadorans that I talked with who are separated from their families and their family members down in El Salvador, you know, it's a terrible thing to not see your kids for 10 years, either because you're living in the U.S. or because you're living in El Salvador and your kids have gone to the U.S., you know, and to not be able to see your grandkids grow up, to that kind of family separation. And, like, a lot of immigrants here, like immigrants from Central America, they don't want to live here. They would much prefer to be able to stay in their communities because there's, you know, their countries are beautiful. El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, they've got amazing community organization in a lot of these places, you know, and they would like to stay if they could. But like you're saying, it's the conditions of not having jobs available, education being so expensive, the violence, which is just going out of control in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala right now. So it's pushing people out. It's not really that they want to come steal our jobs and take away our way of life. You know, they want to stay in their own countries, but they can't.
Yeah, well, when it's a question of starving with no work or going somewhere you might get work, then, you know, people are going to try to survive. They're going
right.
to try to work so they can eat and live, you know,
right.
and they shouldn't be treated as criminals. You know, and that's the way we're treating them. We're treating them like criminals.
Exactly.
You know, and they're not. They're just desperate people, working people, as you say, who are fleeing. They should be treated as political refugees, you know, because that's really what they are, economic political refugees from those countries where U.S. policies are free trade policies. You know, how much does free trade policy, how much of it, NAFTA, North American Free Trade, and CAFTA, Central American Free Trade agreements, responsible for displacing all these people and eliminating jobs and forcing them, to migrate. I mean, people don't talk about that much.
Right.
You know,
but that's, right. Yeah, that's, definitely. In the mainstream media, you're not hearing about that. I think it is good that people are taking advantage of, in the progressive media, people are, you know, bringing it back to that issue of past U.S. foreign policy and U.S. trade policy and current, you know, policy in Central America and how that's responsible. I think, you know, my area of expertise is definitely more Central America than Mexico and NAFTA, but definitely in Central America, since CAFTA came in, you know, over 10 years ago, the agricultural sector has definitely suffered. There has been more immigration, and that's something, you know, the mainstream media has not wanted to cover. And they also, I mean, in my work, accompanying and working with the Salvadoran social movement, we've also seen, and the anti-mining movement, we've seen how these free trade agreements really limit also the sovereignty of the Salvadoran government, for example, to protect its environment. So there's been this big fight going on about gold mining. North American gold mining companies coming into El Salvador, which again is a tiny country the size of Massachusetts, very overpopulated, and they wanted to do gold mining there. And when the people of El Salvador resisted that, and when the government of El Salvador resisted that, the World Bank came down and said, is saying pretty much right now, you know, you can't do that because you have signed onto the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and that has a lot of protections for investors. It doesn't have protections for governments that are trying to protect their water, trying to protect their land, trying to protect the sovereign will of the people. And so, and then also, you know, there's been some coverage of the conflict about this aid package called the Millennium Challenge Grant, and how the U.S. government is trying to say that because of CAFTA, there needs to be changes in the Salvadoran government's purchases of seeds, and pretty much saying that using this free trade agreement and using this aid package to force the Salvador government to buy seeds from Monsanto, from these big foreign companies, mm-hmm. instead of buying seeds from small local farmers. Mm-hmm. That's been a big fight recently, because it's not only, I mean, and that's why it makes you so angry reading about the crisis of immigration, because you're seeing right now in El Salvador that the U.S. government is actively stopping, hindering these efforts that would make life better for, you know, small farmers, for example, in El Salvador. And mining, you know, is another example of something that would make life really difficult for people in El Salvador and would only increase immigration.
Yes, I mean, you make an important point here, and that is these free trade agreements really undermine sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
Meaning what their own governments and people could do in terms of passing legislation or making laws that improve their condition. The free trade agreements mean once you sign them, and this is true for us in the U.S. as well as for people on the other side of the free trade agreement. Once you agree to free trade agreement, then it becomes the bankers and the big corporations, and you cannot legislate against what they do.
Right.
It's part of the free trade agreement. So you're undermining national sovereignty, democratic rights in the simplest sense, and you can't pass laws to make any changes. And obviously, you see that in terms of labor laws and environmental laws,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. The people can't do anything about it. They big corporations and bankers lock in their rights, and once you have these treaties, and there's nothing you can do about it democratically, indigenously, in your own country. So, as you point out, a good example is seeds, Monsanto and GMOs and seeds and so forth. They can't even raise their own seeds anymore. You know, they have to use Monsanto seeds, and that of course means you got a whole part of their agricultural base that disappears. I mean,
right.
We know at NAFTA in Mexico, for example, whole communities in Michoacan and elsewhere have been devastated, and people, you know, can't compete with Monsanto corn, so they are without jobs. They were corn farmers. What are they going to do? They're going to go north, you know. So same
right.
thing, it seems like, is happening in Central America, as you point out. So what do you think is going to happen to be the response on the border? What's your view on that? You got some sense of Obama and the border issue itself? I mean, what do you do with 100,000 people in the last 6 months?
Well, I mean, yeah, if I was one of Obama's advisors, which obviously I'm not, if I, you know, what I would recommend that they do is, instead of using $2 billion that you're talking about, that he's requesting, instead of using the $2 billion for, you know, increasing border enforcement and making the deportation process faster, which is really a backward way of dealing with it, I feel like, is that you should use that $2 billion to put it into making life better in Central America so that people don't feel pushed to go to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, $2 billion could actually do a lot. I know a number of organizations in El Salvador that and in Honduras that are operating with tiny little budgets and doing a lot of things that actually do prevent immigration and that help people feel like they're able to stay in their communities. For example, scholarship programs for high school and college, you know, supporting small businesses, supporting sustainable agriculture, programs of violence prevention, especially in the urban areas. All of those things, $2 billion put into those things would actually stem the tide of people leaving. And, you know, if he's going to deport these people, at least send them back to a better country than the one they left. Because if you deport them back, if you deport a young person back to El Salvador, to a really dangerous, back to their home in this really dangerous part of the capital, let's say, they're just going to leave again, you know. Mm-hmm. And I saw that volunteering down in Arizona with No More Deaths. We saw people who would just go night after night. They'd get picked up. They'd be in the deportation center for a night, and then they just go again and again and again, you know, because nothing has changed about their home community or their home country that makes them feel like they can stay.
Yes, and when economic problems deepen in the exit country, and it appears like you have a job recovery in the U.S., it just stimulates even more immigration. Because people think
right.
they can find work, so you know, when you have that disjoint, that you know, one part of geography is having trouble and the other part is doing better, that's
right.
an incentive
right.
For movement. You know?
Yeah.
So
and,
tell
and
us
really...
more about the conditions back. You know, where these most of these folks are coming from, according from reports from Central America, which is where mm-hmm. you've had some a long time experience. Not so much from Mexico, although we are looking at maybe 10,000 of the total coming from Mexico, according to reports. But most are coming from Central America, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Salvador,
mm-hmm.
Honduras, and maybe.
Guatemala,
yes. So mm-hmm. what is the crisis, the desperation that these folks are facing there?
Yeah, well, I think hearing that there's a big jump of people leaving Honduras is not surprising to me at all, because if I said this in the article, if I was Honduran, I would be gone too, because that country is such a mess since the coup, the military takeover of June 28th, 2009, the country has just, as will happen when you have an undemocratic process, a military takeover, and an illegitimate government put into power, and in this case it was, you know, with the tacit support of the United States government, when this happens, you know, it's just the impunity goes rampant, the violence goes up. And I think that should be mentioned every time that we're talking about this issue of migration from Honduras, and people say, well, San Pedro Sula is the most violent country in the world and Honduras has such high murder rates. That's because they have really high impunity rates, because their police are corrupt, and because they're corrupt from the bottom to the top. You know, they're I was there. I've been there for a number of human rights delegations. I was there in November for the election of their president, and of the Congress. And I was there with a group of 25 people from the U.S. and 25 Salvadoran community organizers. We took a bus up to Honduras. And even the Salvadorans, who have lived through 12 years of civil war, were shocked by what they saw observing the elections at the electoral station. It was just, you know, just crazy fraud. And so that the president, Juan Orlando, he is not a legitimate president. And so, of course, you know, the violence is increasing and people are leaving. I mean, I had friends, Honduran friends, who were taking exile in El Salvador, which is, you know, not the best place to be living either, but it's better than Honduras. So, and then in El Salvador, at least, they have a legitimate democratically elected government. The second left-wing government in the history of El Salvador was elected in March. And so you have a government that's trying, but the gang problem, which has been developing for years because of so much inequality, is really out of control. And in the communities that I worked with, which were rural organized communities, mostly former refugee communities, very isolated, but even there they were seeing the gang problem. We had a scholarship student, a high school scholarship student in this tiny community killed right in front of his home at 2 p.m. in the afternoon because he was dating a girl who used to date a gang member in this tiny little rural community. So it's like people really feel like even the countryside is not safe anymore.
So it's not just the economic crisis in these Central American countries that's forcing people away, but it's a crisis in terms of gangs and crime and political corruption. Mm-hmm. It's a broad spectrum of causes that are forcing people to, you know, to survive, to leave in this case. Is that a fair appraisal?
Yes, I think so, but I think it's very much tied together, you know, the economic problems and the violence problems, because the gangs, the root of the gangs is inequality and poverty, and not just poverty, because some people think of Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala as, oh, everybody's so poor there, but there's a lot of really, really rich people who have, you know, private jets and three homes and live in nannies, and they, you know, so that inequality, I think, creates more violence. And also, you know, the immigration that's been going on since before the Civil War, so since the 70s and the 80s, you know, has divided up families, and that is also has to do with the gangs and these young people. So the gangs have been going, you know, have been building in strength for a long time. So it's all very much tied together, and I think if there was, like I said, if the U.S. government was shifting its priorities in Central America away from making the conditions in Central America better for big businesses, better for mining companies, and they were trying to make life better for normal people, trying to make education more accessible, trying to make jobs more accessible, then we would see a lot of the violence go down as well.
Yes, it certainly, you know, the economic issues in these countries is a big issue here, underlying all the immigration. People should realize that these countries are heavy commodity exporting countries. In other words, food commodities, mining metals, and so forth. And the global commodities markets have pretty much crashed and haven't recovered here for a number of years, which means even people who had jobs in those sectors were laid off or don't have jobs, right? So
yeah. But I think the problems are also very tied together. The problems that we're facing in terms of the economy here and in El Salvador, and that's like the organization that I'm a part of, U.S. El Salvador Sister Cities. That was a big focus of our work, was, for example, connecting communities in, you know, up in Bangor, Maine, agricultural communities with agriculture communities in El Salvador, where in both of those places they're seeing the negative effects of free trade, and where they both have kind of the same vision Like, they want sustainable agriculture and to be able to feed themselves and feed their families and, you know, have farmers markets and all of those things. It's really the, we're so tied together in what we want here in the U.S. and here in and down in El Salvador. And so I think that's really important, is like learning from one another and seeing that, you know, things getting better in the U.S. And things getting better in El Salvador is really tied together. And it's about, you know, shifting the focus away from these the interests of these corporations towards the interests of everyday people.
Yeah. Okay. We need to take a little break here midway through the show, Alexandra. Hold on. We're going to come back, and we're going to let's think about shifting our discussion to back to the border and what's going on in the border right now. If you're up on the latest responses there, and in the meantime, while we take this break, maybe the engineer can pick up the call from David Bacon, who's been trying to call in. Who will call it again, I hope, and the engineer here in the station will pick up his call if he can join us in the second half of the show. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, and we're talking about immigration and children and the humanitarian crisis on the U.S. border right now as we speak. Okay, we'll be back very shortly.
Now sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job, now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming, I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades, we'll be all right.
This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. We're talking today about the immigrants' rights issue and particularly the latest development in that topic on the U.S. border with tens of thousands of children and women and children crossing the border here and creating an issue right before the election again. A humanitarian problem, not just, I mean, what do you do with 100,000 kids? You put them in buses and send them back across and dump them on the streets in northern Mexico. You know, they're just going to cross right back if they can. And what happens to those that can't cross right back? What's going to happen to all those kids on the border, both sides of the border? They're going to be left on their own. I mean, northern Mexico and the border of northern Mexico is not a great place to be either, right? So, how will these kids get exploited if we just dump them across the border here? Presumably you can even pick them up. And what happens on this side of the border? We put them in concentration camps here while we figure out what to do with them? This is a real humanitarian issue of immense proportions. We're talking about tens of thousands of kids, not adults who could maybe fend for themselves a little bit, but kids who have great difficulty on either side of the border being able to care for themselves. I mean, it's criminal not only to deport people and break up families, which is what we've been doing in the last several years, 2 million of them under Obama, but this is even more criminal to send these kids across the border and dump them on the Mexican side of the border and say, you know, wash your hands of it. This is not our problem anymore. I'm not sure exactly how to address the problem in a humanitarian way, but I don't think $2 billion and more deportations is the answer to that. And my guest here today, Alexander Early, who has spent years living in Central America. Most of these kids and women are from Central America, although some from Mexico as well. So she and I have been discussing some of the conditions that have been forcing people to come north, including economic conditions that the U.S. has been creating itself under the Central America Free Trade Agreement, North America Free Trade Agreement, a topic that's seldom discussed. To what extent are we creating, U.S., we creating that problem, and solutions not being dumping people on the other side of the border, they're just going to come back, or worse is going to happen to them, but solutions that should do something about the economies and the political system in the source of where these folks are coming from. Anyway, that's not brought up very much in discussion of these debates. So, Alexandra, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and David, is David Bacon on? I know David's trying to get on. I'm not sure if we... David, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, wonderful. We finally got you back. David, Alexandra, and I have been talking about the topic from her perspective of what's going on in Central America. But before the break, I indicate we want to switch back to what's going on the border. And I know you're pretty much up on that. Maybe you can give us an overview of what's actually happening there on the border that the press is not really fully discussing.
Well, before we get there, I want to, I want to provide a little bit of context as well, too. I'm not sure. I'm sure Alexandra's been doing a great deal of that because I know her work and admire it a great deal.
Okay, go ahead.
But first of all, the migration of families from Mexico and Central America didn't just start with this current, what the media is calling a crisis. This has been going on for a long time. We've had, roughly 400,000, 500,000 people a year crossing the border for over two decades. And if we want to talk about the migration of people from Central America, we really have to go back to the late 1970s and the early 1980s, because the big migration from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua came about because of the U.S. wars, the U.S. promoted wars in Central America. So we had 2 million people, for instance, from El Salvador, who came to the United States, a great many of whom then settled in Los Angeles, along with other cities, San Francisco, Miami, and others, as well as people fleeing the violence of the military regime in Guatemala and then the U.S.-Contra War in Nicaragua. So what that really meant was, first of all, that there were Salvadoran families who were divided and Central American families who were divided. In other words, some people stayed behind or were left behind in Central America, and other people came and established themselves and established communities here in the United States. And this has been the situation now for really about 35 years. And as a result of that, first of all, you have to think about what happened to people when they got to the United States. People coming from El Salvador and Guatemala especially were not welcome to the United States. In fact, the Reagan administration did everything that it could to send people back, to refuse to grant people legal status, to basically punish people, because the migration of people out of Central America gave the lie to the U.S. Claim that it was fighting for democracy in Central America. In fact, it was fighting for these regimes that were extremely right-wing, conservative, elite, that benefited only a tiny proportion of the people who lived in those countries. And so the people who came here as refugees fleeing those wars came into the bottom of U.S. society. In other words, they had the worst jobs, the most difficult conditions, the most, I remember Ana Martinez, who is an organizer for the United Electrical Workers when I worked for the union back in the early 1990s. And when Ana came, she came as a domestic worker. She slept in the hallways of apartment buildings with, many other people who were in the same situation. People had no money. were extremely vulnerable, and that was life. Anna, in her case, she was able to finally, after working for a number of years, bring her son from El Salvador. She had been a trade unionist in El Salvador and had come here fleeing for her life, and she brought her son here. And what happened to her son happened to a great many young people from El Salvador, and that was they were living in downtown Los Angeles in the Ramparts neighborhood, and her son got recruited into a gang. These were gangs that existed already in that neighborhood, but with this huge number of people coming in, the other sons and daughters of those migrants got incorporated into the gangs who were already there, or at least a lot of them did. Anna voluntarily sent her son back to El Salvador to escape that kind of life. But what really happened to most young people was that over the years, they became victims of the U.S. deportation policy. And they were, after they got picked up for whatever minor or major activity that they were involved in, they were sent back to El Salvador. And so there was a huge wave of deportations of young people back to El Salvador, which meant essentially that the gang culture of Los Angeles got reproduced.
So we've been exporting gang culture. That's right.
In El Salvador and in Guatemala. In fact, communities in Mexico as well, too. You know, the communities that were receiving these young people had a very conflicting feelings about them because on the one hand, they were the sons and daughters of people in that community. And on the other hand, they were people who had become, you know, they had adopted a certain lifestyle that many people viewed as a threat. The U.S. then went to Central America and through our law enforcement assistance operations, in other words, we give money. The United States government gives money to the police and the army in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras for sure. And the conditions for that money was that those police departments then implement the war on drugs in those countries. And the war on drugs, really what it meant is, was that when those young people got off the plane at the airport in Ilopango, in El Salvador, or in Guatemala City, almost right away, they got arrested by the police there and thrown into prison. So the police, with the U.S. support, really shut the door to any kind of normal life that those young people might have had a chance to have in those countries that they were being deported back to. And those prisons then also became recruiting grounds for gangs that then began to reproduce in those countries. That's where a lot of the violence is coming from. So you could say that the violence in El Salvador and in Guatemala and Honduras was produced by U.S. policy, by the wars, then by how people were treated once they fled to the United States, what happened to the young people, by the deportation policy, and then by the law enforcement policy, the war on drugs. So, you know, when you have people who are coming out of those countries, basically who are coming to the United States to get away from violence or to get away from poverty or to get away from the mixture of those two things, people are coming here to get away from what U.S. policy produced. And so, and that wave of people has been coming and coming and coming and coming and coming. You know, it's true that the number of people, young people, coming to the border today is greater than it has been for a while. So we're seeing a kind of a increase in the number of families and the number of young people who are coming here. But it's not something that's new. It's something that's been happening for quite a while. So what has happened then in terms of what we see in this country is the youth of this wave of people coming here by the Tea Party. About 3 weeks ago, we saw on a website called Breitbart.com pictures of dozens and dozens and dozens of young people who were being held in these rooms in detention centers as though they were animals. And they were very shocking pictures. It's true, they were. But the first thing is that where did the pictures come from? The pictures were coming from the Border Patrol itself and the guards in privately run detention centers, because nobody else can get into those centers to take those pictures. So the Border Patrol and the private detention companies, they leaked to this website these pictures in order to create a political crisis or a political project, I guess you would say. And Breitbart.com is a very right-wing website that's tied to the Tea Party in Texas. And the person who they leaked it to is a guy named Brandon Darby, who was an FBI informant who sent a couple of the protesters against the Republican National Convention in 2008 to prison as a result of his provocation and his activities, and then became a right-wing blogger. And so the Border Patrol essentially leaked these photographs to this guy, who then put them on the Breitbart.com website, and all of a sudden we see these speeches in Congress by some of the most right-wing Congress members saying this is proof that the Obama immigration policy is a disaster. And then they began doing things like, for instance, they said, well, okay, the reason why young people are coming here is because of DACA, because of the fact that the Obama administration granted deferred action, in other words, deferring the deportation of people who were brought here as youth. The right wing has been after this policy for a long time, trying to get it undone. And also, in the United States right now, the immigrant rights movement is trying to force the Obama administration to actually expand that policy and to say, okay, if you're going to defer the deportation of these young people, what about their families? You should be deferring the deportation of anybody who is not a criminal here in the United States. So here are these pictures, and these speeches in Congress were being used to attack the Deferred Action Program and to close the door to any possibility that the Trump administration might expand it. The second step toward doing this was to make it very, very difficult for anybody in the Republican Party to propose any kind of immigration reform that had any kind of legalization attached to it. And that worked. And that worked because about a week later, Boehner, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, made this speech and told the Obama administration that he wasn't going to bring any immigration reform bill to a vote on the House floor. So they shut the door to those comprehensive immigration reform bills. A lot of people, including myself, don't like those bills and oppose those bills for other reasons because they were extremely punitive bills. But the Tea Party, what they didn't want was they didn't want legalization. And so they got Boehner to shut that door. And the third thing that they wanted out of this was an increase in the resources for enforcement and the Border Patrol. And they got that too.
That's the $2 billion.
That's right. Because the Obama administration's response to this pressure from the Tea Party was to say, we are going to increase enforcement on the border. We are going to ask Congress for an additional $2 billion, which, of course, is going to go to these private prison operators and to even more people for the Border Patrol. And you have to remember that the United States government right now is spending more money on immigration enforcement than all of the other law enforcement programs of the federal government combined. In other words, FBI plus DEA plus ATF plus all the rest of them altogether don't make up as much as immigration enforcement. And here's the Obama administration saying, we're going to expand it. We're going to give it another $2 billion. The other thing he was doing, though, which is something that is really very, has people very, very angry and upset, is that he's trying to go around the law. In the Bush administration, there was a law passed, but there was, that said that for that when the Border Patrol picks up minors who are not from Mexico, in other words, not from the country that's right on the other side of the border, they cannot keep them in detention and just deport them. They have to turn them over to the Department of Health and Human Services, which will then try and locate their families in the United States and release them to their families. In other words, it's kind of a humanitarian law, really. And the Obama administration said that it was going to suspend the operation of that law and simply hold children for deportation and then just put them on planes and send them back to Guatemala.
When did the Obama administration make that decision, not to try to relocate but to send them back? Is that, was that recent?
That was about a week ago.
Oh, very recent.
Very, very, very recent. So this is basically Obama retreating under pressure from the right wing, from the Tea Party, that has used this increase in the number of young people coming from Central America as a way to put on political pressure. And this has been followed by other things as well, too. I think a lot of listeners might have seen in the paper that there was a this kind of demonstration by these racist nativists in Murrieta, California, which is in northern San Diego County. And there, you know, the Border Patrol has been relocating young people from the centers where they were originally kept when they were crossing the border, relocating them to other centers, saying that they don't have enough space. And so there's a center, a detention center in Murrieta, California, and they put about three busloads of young people on, or they took a bunch of young people and put them on three buses and sent them to Murrieta. Now, somehow, the Tea Party, these very right-wing people, got wind of these buses that were coming there, and they mobilized themselves and sat down in front of the buses, and then with all of these racist signs and American flags and so forth, and the Border Patrol then turned the buses around and sent them back to where they were coming from, saying, oh, this is a danger somehow, or this is a community outrage, outpouring of outrage against the relocation of these young people. So, you know, this effort by the right wing and by the Tea Party and these nativist groups is increasing, actually, and their cooperation and their collusion with the Border Patrol is becoming very evident. And the purpose of it is, essentially, is to force the Obama administration to increase enforcement. You know, we already are deporting 400,000 people a year, you know, 2 million people in the last 5 years, and that's not enough. And here's the Obama administration saying, well, in the short run, we're going to increase enforcement. In the long run, well, maybe by the end of the summer, we might require the Immigration and Customs Enforcement to be a little bit more humanitarian in the way that they're enforcing the law. But in the short run, we are going to increase enforcement by these various measures.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing is the right wing, the Tea Party, are upping their manipulation of this issue, and they are pushing Obama further to the right in terms of taking reactionary positions, deportation positions, which, of course, is not anything new whenever the conservatives and the right wing raise and push an issue. Obama tends to move to the right. And so this is very, we've seen this for years now. And what's ironic is, you know, it's Latin American Hispanic people that put him in the office here in 2012, and we're still seeing this kind of a talk. Now, what do you think will be forthcoming? Obama says, well, he's going to make immigration smarter, whatever the hell that means. But I suspect he's going to throw a pie-in-the-sky promise of immigration reform or something right before the election to get those folks to vote for him again. You got any sense of what Obama may be forthcoming, what he may be doing, both in terms of more deportation with this $2 billion and or in terms of some carrot to add to the stick here policy?
Well, I think you're describing it pretty accurately here, because really Obama is sort of making promises to the left and to the right, okay? But the problem here is that the promises to the right are more than promises. In other words, his speeding up of the deportations is happening right now. He's not just promising it. He's doing it. He's doing it. So he's moving to the right in terms of his immediate actions. And at the same time, he is saying to the Latino community, to the Asian American community, to the community of African migrants here, to unions, to people on the left, he's saying, look, let me cover myself by increasing enforcement. And by the end of August, my team, he says, he calls it his team, will recommend ways in which we can make our immigration enforcement more humane. And so in saying that, what he's doing is he is responding to this pressure that has been building for quite a while here, for the last couple of years at least, pressure to basically stop the deportation policy, to stop deporting 400,000 people a year, and instead provide people a means for staying in the United States who don't have papers and working. It's not just staying here that counts, it's also being able to work, because part of the enforcement policy is basically trying to force employers to fire workers without papers, which is happening also by the tens of thousands. So Obama's under a lot of pressure to stop both of these kinds of enforcement policies. And he's also looking at the election and knows and understands that the continuation of this heavy-handed enforcement policy is going to cost him a lot of votes. And so, as you say, he's making promises now that he is going to soften up that policy at some point down the line, presumably before the election, but not right away. So what we're getting here is we are getting the heavy-handed enforcement right now, especially directed at children. You know, this is the scandal of it, is that this is not directed at, you know, some kind of, you know, the supposed stereotype image of the drug dealer or the smuggler or the what have you. This is directed at families and children. These are the people who are stuck in those detention centers coming from Central America. And instead of doing the humane thing here and allowing people to find their families here in the United States and to reunite with them and live with them, you know, the policy is deportation. So that's what we're getting in the short term, with the promise of something happening in the long term. You know, so what we get is, you know, also something that's also become sort of characteristic of the immigrant rights situation in the United States over the last few years, and that is, you know, we have these heavily funded, big ticket advocacy groups in Washington, D.C., who are saying, oh, give the administration a chance. You know, let it, you know, Obama's really trying to do the right thing. Let's give him enough political space to do that. While at the same time, immigrant rights groups around the country are saying, what are you talking about? You know, these are children. We have to do something right now.
Right. Well, that's been the story for 6 years. We're getting the message here that we're running out of time, but I would like to invite both of you back before the end of the summer here to talk about this issue again from the perspective of what are the immigrants' rights groups' responses in the U.S. To this issue, because it certainly will pick up. It's going to be a big issue before the election, and we will see more hard-nosed actual policies, as you say, David, in the next few weeks. And then we will see at the end of this summer, end of August, as Obama has said, his pie-in-the-sky promises of what he will do after he does what he is doing, I guess you might say. But can both you and Alexandra come back and talk to us about the movement's response to this maybe sometime in August?
Sure.
Okay, great. Let's do that, because, you know, in this show we want to talk about grassroots movements, what they're doing. And this issue is, again, on the radar screen as it's never gone away, as an important election year, midterm election year issue. So thank you both for the excellent analysis and reporting on what's happening, Alexandra, on your basis of your experience and what's actually going on in these Central American countries, and David, your excellent analysis on what's happening on the border here and the politics of this. So once again, we will revisit this issue. Next week, listeners, we're going to talk about the militarization of the U.S. police force in the wake of the Middle East wars here. So tune in next week. We'll talk about militarization of police in the U.S., and then we will be back with this issue sometime in several weeks ahead. But thank you again for your excellent responses and analysis. This is Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus. Tune in next week. We'll be seeing you again.